Hope you were as refreshed by this morning's worship experience as I was. It's always, when you do something different from the way you've been doing it, it's a little jarring. You have to adjust a bit. This is one of, well, it may be the most loving church family I've ever worshiped with, and I know that your love, if nothing else, your love for each other, your love for the young people, will certainly override any discomfort that you had, because as I've heard said many times, when we come together, it's not about me. It's not about me. All right, last week, back up, this class... is what we're doing is we're focusing on Jesus as it's seen played out in the lives of people in Scripture and in our own church history. And so we fix our eyes on Jesus as we learn from models that we've had over the centuries. Now this last class, what we started last week, is a look at how people have, or how God has used the desert to train his people. He's always done that. As long as there have been deserts and people, he has used deserts to train his people. Now, it may feel like I had kind of a jarring sidestep into a completely different topic called the Sabbath. But it's not a different topic, and we'll get to that in just a minute. I knew last week that we wouldn't get through the entire lesson. We got actually about where I thought we would get, and as I've thought about it throughout the week and kind of thought back on the class, especially my presentation of the class, there's something that I want to make sure you didn't get. You didn't hear me say. Okay. Last week, if you walked away from class last week thinking, oh man, the Sabbath is another thing I got to add to my schedule, where am I going to find time? If you had that sense, then I need to apologize, because that's actually the exact thing that Jesus came down on the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, for, is making the Sabbath too complicated. The Sabbath is an invitation. It should be as inviting to you as your bed after a hard day's work. The Sabbath is rest for your soul. Also rest for your body, but that's almost incidental to the rest that you'll get for your soul. When I was a little kid, I remember being confused by something, and we'd go on long trips to Arkansas to see grandparents and things. And I remember asking my dad one time, why is it when you drive that you make these little motions with your hands? You're turning the wheel just a little bit. You never just stay straight. And it was obvious he had never thought about that before, but he said, well, I guess, you know, there's a lot of imperfections in the road, and you just kind of have to do that or else you'll drive off the road. But even as a teenager, I was driving, I remember it doesn't make sense on paper that if the highway is straight and your car is fairly well aligned, it doesn't make sense that you would still have to make those little movements to stay on the road. But we know what happens if you just lock it, you'll end up in the bar ditch. And so, of course, the reason is, The road, even though it looks straight, there are little micro adjustments and things in the pavement, little imperfections along the way. And even if there weren't, even if it was just made out of, I don't know, metal or something, and you were just on a straight shot, you would still have to do that, because you can't figure out the perfect way to go by yourself. You're not that skilled. Nobody is. And so you've got to constantly compensate for the last mistake you made. You've got to constantly make little adjustments to be able to get back on the path. That's what the Sabbath is. That's really all it is. It's just a little adjustment that you make in yourself in the week that gets you back established on the right path. And what path are we talking about here? It's the path of what's really important. It's the Sabbath is about you getting reestablished in your relationship to God and each other with what's really important. And so, again, I've used this picture before, but think of it this way. You've got that single throne in your heart. During the week, you know, on Sunday, boy, we put God on that throne. We've worshiped him. We're on fire. He is on the throne. This afternoon, time has passed. And I look and, whoa, I got part of my hiney up there on that throne again. I got to get myself off. And so during the week, if you're not careful, you'll replace God on that throne in your heart. And you won't even realize it. That's the definition of insidious. When something happens, you don't even realize it. It's over a long period of time, but it's huge in its effect. It really takes over. Some of the best conversation about the class last week that I had was after the bell rang. Jim Bob came up. He said, you know, the Sabbath is un-American. Now, I want you to explain what you meant when you said that, because I don't want to misquote you. For posterity.
The way most of our, at least people my age, feel about things, if we're not busy, we think we ought to be. And I mean, the whole country really is workaholics. And the idea of resting is something weak people do. Mm-hmm. I had a neighbor one time, and it's kind of funny. He was that kind of person. And so I said, Robert, I said, you're not a very good Baptist, because all the Baptists I knew when I was growing up would not work on Sunday. He said, they were just lazy.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of mindset most of us have.
You're right. Our culture does not make it easy for us to honor a Sabbath rest. The fact of the matter is, remember I was using the sleep analogy last week. The fact of the matter is, if you go without sleep, you won't be able to think clearly after a while. And you can even watch it in yourself, or somebody can watch it for you. You won't be able to hold a phone number in your head. Some of you, that's the case already, but I mean, you'll get to the point to where you can't remember things that would have been easy for you a few days before. You just, like, you can look at a playing card and not be able to say what that card is after a while, because your brain is swelling. Physically, you're having changes to your body because you've gone without sleep. Now, if you go without REM sleep especially, you'll notice these differences, and eventually your body will shut down and you will begin to die. Literally, that's what happens. So using that analogy, I think we can safely say the same thing is true of the Sabbath. And if you've never celebrated the Sabbath, don't think, oh man, I'm dead and I didn't even know it. Because what it is it's a spiritual death that comes. But remember what the Sabbath is. It's a rest for your soul, to rest in the sovereignty of God. And you can say, I don't have to do I don't have to save myself. It's God who does that. And that's the rest that we get to enjoy. The Sabbath and observing the Sabbath is a way for us to regularly remind ourselves of that. That's really all it is. But if you go long enough without reminding your soul of who's really in charge, you won't be able to think clearly spiritually. You will lose your connection with God, and His Spirit to guide your thoughts and for you to respond to that wisdom. And eventually, you will begin to die spiritually because you're going into the bar ditch, to mix my metaphors there. You're not adjusting your soul. We sang a song. We sang several songs to God. Did you know one of the songs we sang was to our own soul? Bless the Lord, O my soul. We're quoting David, okay, in the Psalms. But we're saying to ourselves, hey, remember who's really important. Remember to bless God. And we have to do that. That's why God makes observing the Sabbath one of the Ten Commandments. He said, you've got to be commanded to do this or you won't do it. I know you. You'll work like dogs. But rest. Take it easy. Take a break. Another comment after class last week was Sandy. She was talking about Mary and Martha and how beautiful a picture that is of the Sabbath rest. Now, we come down on Martha a lot. There are times in your life when you do have to get things done, okay? And maybe Mary has an ongoing problem of not helping around the house. But for that moment, it wasn't time to work. It was time to rest and let your soul be ministered to by Jesus. And so I thought that was a great connection that you made there, a picture of what the Sabbath is all about. It's not about, well, today is my Sabbath rest, so doggone it, I was going to go out and I saw that my neighbor's yard need to be mowed and I can't do it the rest of the week. Today would have been my only day, but I'm not going to be able to do well. Jesus said, look, if one of your animals falls in the ditch, get it out. That's not what the Sabbath is all about. The Sabbath is you planning to rest, yes. But, and I can't remember who was, it may have been you, Jim Bob, that made the comment, it doesn't have to just be a 24-hour period, one specific day in the week. There are occupations that make that impossible. In Jesus' day, there were slaves that had zero opportunity for a Sabbath rest. If you're in med school, you're going to go years without the ability to say, I'm just going to take the next 24 hours and just... You can't always do that. But I also wouldn't relegate it to, well, I'll make going to bed my Sabbath rest, because that's not what it's all about. It is about ceasing from work, yes. But it's ceasing from work so that you can trust that God will give you what you need and maybe what you thought you could have worked for to get it, okay? In other words, the Sabbath is resting from relying on myself to relying on God. Okay, that's what it's all about. Now, should Christians still, I hope that by now you can answer this question yourself, should we still observe the Sabbath? Again, it's not just a Saturday thing. If you want to do it the way the Jews did it, sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Is that right, Sandy? Three stars in the sky? Yeah, okay. That's the way the Jews did it. There's nothing wrong with doing that. That if you want to do it that way, do it. There's also nothing wrong with sundown Saturday to sundown Sunday. That's about when I do it, okay? It doesn't always work out to where I can do it all that time, or sometimes I kind of eat into the work week a little bit. My Sabbath is a little longer than 24 hours, but it may need to be chopped up. However you can get it. It's just like there's no rule for when you have to sleep with your body. Okay, your body needs sleep, but God didn't say it has to be from this time to this time. If it becomes about the rules, we're going back to what Jesus was hammering those Pharisees for. That's not what the Sabbath is all about. Then it becomes another chore, something else I got to schedule. Rest is not something you need to work for. That's kind of ironic. We've got to work hard so we can observe the Sabbath. Well, you have to prepare yourself mentally and physically. But as far as rest, we cannot rest if we've got the work mindset that Jim Bob was talking about. Yeah.
Do you think that the Sabbath rest and the idea of meditation are the same or very similar?
First of all, what do y'all think? I have my thought about that. What do y'all think? Sabbath rest and meditation, are they the same thing? Are they similar? Are they related somehow? What do you think?
Well, I think you're resting in meditation.
Okay. You're resting in meditation? But okay, so meditation is part of the rest, okay? Maybe like dreams are part of sleep. I can carry an analogy too far, so I don't want to do that. But meditation, to me, meditation is thinking about an aspect of God, Scripture, or just in general. And the Sabbath is a great time to do that. So I would say they're different, but you can certainly use thinking about God during the Sabbath rest to help guide your soul.
That's kind of where I was going to go with it. But we're told to meditate on the Word day and night. We're told to meditate continuously, to pray continuously. These are this is something that kind of carries, I think. I think meditation is something that kind of carries that Sabbath throughout our week.
Good.
Whereas it is part of our Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
and we should do it even during the Sabbath, meditate day and night all the time. But it's not necessarily the same as the Sabbath.
And you can find islands during the week of Sabbath rest, a little nap, if you will, that you can take during the work week, where on your lunch break, you just sit down and you focus on what it really means for God's kingdom to come on earth the way it's come in heaven. What does that really mean? Okay, that's giving meditation a little Sabbath. Yes.
What you're talking about, I've been practicing that for 2 months, day in, day out, in my sleep, when I wake up, on every aspect of my life. And so meditating, sleeping with the Word, waking up with the Word, waking up with praise and worship, man, you get rest. You feel good. That's the only place you're going to get your rest at.
That's good.
So for me, living in that is my rest. So meditation, yes, it is rest. It's rest in Him. That's where it's at.
Good. Thank you. Somebody turn to Matthew chapter 11. We're going to read 28 through 30. Matthew 11. And while we're turning there, let me just do a follow-up on what Jim Bob was saying. The word meditation can be intimidating because it implies things that Jesus didn't imply, God didn't imply when he told Joshua, meditate on these day and night. We have images of how it's been corrupted over the years. Eastern people meditating on nothingness and wanting to become one with nothingness. That's not what meditation is all about. Reminds me of that joke. What did the Buddhist say to the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything. That's silly. Okay, Rick.
I was just going to say that when you look at Hebrews, which is the book...
Chapter 4. Okay.
You're going to discover that the Sabbath rest is more of an attitude.
Good.
Because he says, don't enter my rest. God says, they're not going to enter my rest because of their unbelief.
The Israelites.
And then down towards the end of chapter 3, he talks about the people that Moses was most concerned about and upset with, about them not entering the rest. was because of their disobedience. Mm-hmm. So disobedience, the opposite of that is to obey. Unbelief, the opposite of that is to believe or to have faith. This is the Sabbath rest that God's talking about.
Yeah.
And it's based on his promises. Unbelief or disobedience is to question God's promises. God's promise to do what he's going to do for me out of my faithfulness, not because I've earned it, but because that's the quality he's looking for.
Yeah.
And without that attitude, it makes no difference whether we cease all work, we're doing it for the wrong reason. That's not going to be acceptable to God.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm trying to get us to see out of Hebrews 3 and 4 is that it is not just, like you say, a box to check.
Mm-hmm.
It's an attitude that we have to evoke.
Good, good. We're going to get into Hebrews 4 in our discussion, which builds on Hebrews 3. He makes some points in Hebrews 3 and then talks about how Jesus is better. He's brought something better than all of that. One thing just to get you thinking along these lines, I want you to take what Rick just said and think of it in these terms. People are always wondering, is it a sin if I do X? Okay. The question itself shows that their mindset is wrong. Their perspective of sin is wrong. What you have to do is ask, what is sin? Sin is simply not believing in God, not believing that he is sovereign and not allowing that to be in your life, not allowing his sovereignty in your life. After that, you can answer the question yourself. Is this a sin? Well, is God sovereign in this? Okay, so is this a sin is not even a question that you would ask anymore. Once you recognize what sin really is. Somebody who has Matthew 11, read verses 28 through 30. See what Jesus said about the Sabbath rest.
Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Especially in comparison to the burdens that their teachers were giving them. They couldn't carry the burden of the Sabbath anymore. You had to go to a Pharisee to find out, is this a sin? Is this a sin if I do this? And Jesus said, my burden is so light. It's so easy. Terry, could you get a microphone over here? Slow. And his point here is, I will give you rest for your soul, not just your body. Yeah.
Is the Sabbath symbolic like all the other things in the Old Testament, the tabernacle or Adam, and I mean, all the other things, and heaven is our Sabbath rest?
Oh, that's such an important question. The reason it's important is because that's, I hope, where we're getting our mindset. Yes, the Sabbath is a representation on earth of what it's going to be like to be with God forever. It's going to be a rest, but it's not going to be we don't work. Personally, I believe we're going to have new bodies on a new earth, and we're going to go about doing the things we did before, only it's going to be perfect. You're not going to see bad news on TV anymore. You're going to see only good stuff. You know, the Cowboys are going to win every time. But no, you're going to see people working together and being one because they're unified in God. That's the rest that we're looking forward to. Just really everything that we do as a Christian is symbolic at some point. Baptism, it's the death, it's the resurrection. Communion, it's getting married, okay? That's the wedding of God and mankind. So everything that we do as Christians, yes, is very much symbolic. All right, so please keep this idea in mind of what the Sabbath is all about, what it's not, because we don't want to make it into something that it's not.
David, let me share a funny story. Many of you knew my father-in-law was a Baptist preacher for 45-plus years, and he was an interesting character. Well, we mowed his yard when I was in high school. I had a partner, and we had in excess of 30 yards we did every week. And one August, it came, it was really wet, and the dew was so heavy in the mornings we couldn't work. We couldn't mow up until after lunch every day, and so we were so far behind. So we went to do the parsonage, the First Baptist Church parsonage, one Sunday. Bad mistake. My soon-to-be father-in-law, a few years later, explained to me that that was the Baptist Church's house, and we were not to do it on Sunday. And I tried to explain to him that my ox was in the ditch. And he explained to me that if I mowed his yard again on Sunday, I'd be in the ditch with the ox.
Does that sound like him, Slow?
That's good. That's funny. All right. So how does this relate to John the Baptist, people in the desert? Well, like we've already established, the Sabbath is like a miniature desert experience. This also answers, why does God use the desert to train his people? Like I said last week, there's nothing there to attract man, and so God uses it. But the reason is you've got to get away from the distractions of life in order sometimes to be able to focus on God. When Elijah was in the cave, God, his voice wasn't in the whirlwind, it wasn't in the fire, it wasn't in the earthquake, it wasn't in the things that you would normally, it would grab your attention. His was the whisper. And sometimes, if we really want to hear God's voice, we have to be very quiet. And sometimes our lives get to the point to where we can't get all the things done in time. We put instant coffee in the microwave, you know, and so we want things done yesterday. And that mindset, it'll go with us even on a vacation to where we can't even rest on a vacation. But that mindset will eat at us. And so even observing a weekly Sabbath rest is difficult because our minds aren't there. Well, in those cases, God says, you need the desert. In the desert, you don't have the distractions. You don't have, I mean, if you have a cell phone, it's not going to do you much good because you don't have service. No TV, no. But more importantly, you don't have. One reason it's nice to stay in a hotel is because you don't constantly have to think, oh man, I need to straighten this room up. I need to make the bed. They'll do that for you. They'll take care of that, okay? Just so in a desert, suddenly your biggest concern is not what you're going to, how you're going to get both of these things done tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock for the boss. Suddenly it's, do I have any dry socks? It's very, very streamlined, very simple. Now, the desert is a metaphorical thing too, just like everything else. Yes, he uses physical deserts. I think he still does. But he also uses times in our lives where we feel like, God, I'm in a desert. I'm praying, but nothing's happening. I don't feel anything anymore. Or you're just going through a really hard time in your life for emotions or whatever reason. And you can look at that as a desert experience. So we got two comments, James and then Janine.
I'm coming.
I had a couple of, the first one, talking about the small, the quiet voice. Mm-hmm. I had a, well, she was a speech teacher at Odessa College. And when the class would get loud and boisterous and everybody was talking, mm-hmm. rather than shouting to get everybody to quiet down, she'd start talking softly. And everything she said softly was going to be on the test.
So you learn in a hurry to be quiet.
My other point is I don't guess I had ever thought of it before, but when Adam and Eve sinned and they had to leave the Garden of Eden, and you don't think about what God putting them out of the Garden of Eden as an act of grace or act of love, but the only way they were going to be able to take care of themselves was to be to go to the desert. And so that's where he took them, where there were thistles and thorns, and life was going to be tough.
I hadn't really thought about it. I'm glad you framed it like that. Our entire life experience is a desert experience. That's a good way to say it. Janine.
I think you made a very valid point last week when you said it's not necessarily just sitting down and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Allow yourself to just do what you want to do.
Right.
And Jerry, I think, would agree with me. He's been in the desert some with work and various things.
Yeah.
Yesterday I told him, I said, you need to rest. And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, whatever you want to do. And I think he worked on some things that were work-related, but he had the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not work when you have the choice
of
doing it.
Yeah, it is a mindset, like Jim Bob was saying. It's completely up here and in here that your soul will be refreshed. REM sleep for the soul comes only when your mindset is right. So we need to be people who establish a regular pattern, and God established it once a week, so we need it at least that often, of restoring our soul, refreshing our soul. We take care of the circumstance to allow that to happen. We also take care of the not working or having the choice, as Janine says. But God does the actual refreshment of the soul. We're not in charge of that. We don't even know how. But if you keep your compass set to the Lord of the Sabbath, He will realign your relationship with the Creator. He will realign your relationship with the creation. And He'll realign your understanding of who you really are. All right, so these people that we're going to take a look at today, John Chrysostom and Mary of Egypt, those are both people who went to the desert. We probably need a little background. I don't know how far this goes. Okay. All right, so Constantine legalized Christianity in 313, all right? In just a few decades, things changed from being a Christian could well cost you your life to, if you're not a Christian, you're probably not going to get that elected position in government that you were wanting to get. The rise of the social, not just social, but even political Christian, it didn't happen overnight, but it happened within the lifetime of some people. They saw this incredible shift in what it meant to be a Christian. So 313 was the year it was legalized. Within a half century, you started hearing about people going out into the desert, Christians going out into the desert. One thing in our discussion that I want to get to is the question, is there a connection between the meteoric rise of social Christianity and people going out into the desert? All right, they were hermits, okay? They lived by themselves in caves at first. They were true hermits at first. But, I mean, life will make you a believer of community, if nothing else will. And they realized it's a whole lot easier to survive if you get together, even as hermits. So they built little communities, little huts and things in groups. And they they took the idea of the monastery, and I say they took it because I don't know that they were aware of it. The Buddhists had been doing monasteries for centuries, way back to the time of Siddhartha Gautama. But for Christians, the idea is probably just a very pragmatic one. We need a community of people to help us survive. And so we refer to these Christians who were in the desert as desert fathers. And in the last several decades, people have started acknowledging there were a lot of women out there too. They were the, so they've given them the name desert mothers. And so when they talk about these people, like John Chrysostom, in the Catholic Church, they'll refer to him as Abba John Chrysostom, Saint John Chrysostom, but they'll also call him Abba because he's a church father. He's a desert father, not a church father, sorry. And then the mothers, this is just acknowledging our Hebrew roots. The mothers are called Amma, Amma, Mary of Egypt. So John Chrysostom, who was this guy? John was the name given to him by his parents. Chrysostom, it wasn't like he was born to Mr. and Mrs. Chrysostom. That was just a description of how he talked. It means golden mouth. He was an eloquent speaker. The opposite of Moses, I guess you'd say. He preached against church leaders abusing their authority in his day. In fact, he reminds me a lot of his locust-eating namesake in Scripture, John the Baptist. And we're just 50 or 60 years here from when Christianity was first legalized. But when he was young, he was baptized. That's his death date, by the way. He was baptized in his 20s. He became a successful lawyer. But his real interest lay in theology. Theology, literally in Greek, it means study of God. And that's what he loved to do. And just before he turned 30, he decided to go out into the desert and become a hermit, like some others he had heard about. And so from about 375 to 377, John Chrysostom lived in those extreme desert conditions. But it wasn't enough for him. And I want you to keep this in mind when we're talking about why this connection between social Christianity and what they're doing out there. He would fast from food. He would fast from sleep. He would fast from lying down. He would try to sleep standing up sometimes. Sometimes he would fast even from sitting down. He would just stand for days. He would put himself through such physical torture that he would actually suffer physical ailments for the rest of his life as a result of what he had done to himself out in the desert. And you're going to find that theme throughout church history, that you will... you'll see people who are leaders in the church who struggle physically with a lot of medical ailments because they had put themselves through such rigors. In fact, the reason John Chrysostom returned to civilization, Antioch, was because he had so badly damaged his stomach and his kidneys that he had to get a doctor's attention. So Martin Luther, by the way, we'll get him much later, but he's another one who suffered medical conditions for the rest of his life. Well, when he came back to Antioch, the people were instantly impressed with the things he was saying, with the way he taught, and so they wanted to make him their bishop, and they did in Antioch. And over the next 12 years, he really, his fame spread just empire-wide. It's also where he began to denounce the corruption that had swept church leadership already. Let me give you a quote, just to kind of give you the way his mind worked. This is from one of his sermons. We still have copies of lots of his sermons. "Do you wish to honor the body of Christ? Do not ignore him when he's naked. Do not pay him homage in the temple clad in silk, only then to neglect him outside where he is cold and ill clad. He who said, "This is my body," is the same who said, "You saw me hungry and you gave me no food. And whatsoever you did to the least of my brothers, you also did for me." What good is it if the Eucharistic table, the Lord's Supper, is overloaded with golden chalices when your brother's dying of hunger? Start by satisfying his hunger, and then with what is left over, you may adorn the altar as well. The church in Constantinople decided, you know, he's wasted in a little town like Antioch. It wasn't a little town, but Constantinople was the capital. It had become the new capital of the Roman Empire. And so you've heard of churches stealing preachers from other churches. They actually, this literally is how it happened. They had to sneak into Antioch at night and usher him out at night because they knew the people would, and they did, they erupted like a mob that to find out that their man had been taken away. So John Chrysostom, he was a hit with the common man. As you can tell, you know, he had a heart for those who are marginalized. He was a bit of a burr in the saddle of the wealthy. And when they took him to the capital of the Roman Empire, that's where the leaders of government were. That's where a lot of social and political Christians were meeting together. And even though he was bishop of that city, he refused to host the expensive meals that had become customary for the bishop to host. Instead, he admonished church leaders to be the servants of the people, the common man. And again, like his biblical namesake, John Chrysostom spoke out against the wife of the emperor himself. Remember, John the Baptist did that, and he was arrested and eventually beheaded. Well, when Chrysostom spoke out against the wife of the emperor, because he was speaking out against a bunch of the leadership, he was banished from the city. Well, contemporaries were quick to come to the emperor's wife and say, okay, what you're doing may have been a little hasty. The people are rioting in the streets. They were all saying she's like Herodias, you know, wanting John's head on the platter. And so that night, there was an earthquake in Constantinople. And there was no doubt in anyone's mind that the emperor's wife had done a bad thing. In fact, even the emperor's wife could take a hint. She very apologetically asked Chrysostom to come back to the city. He came back, didn't last long, though. There was a big ceremony that took place. The emperor's wife, her name was Eudoxia, by the way. She was commemorating herself with a silver statue there in the city. And so it was being erected, and there was a big ceremony that was taking place right there in Constantinople. Well, Chrysostom said the whole thing's idolatry. It's pagan worship. These people are worshiping a person. Well, this time he was banished from the city for good. Earthquake or no, he was out and he was never going to come back. And in response, the people burned down the cathedral. They showed her they were not to be trifled with. John himself was not at all vengeful in spirit. He just went back to ministering to common people when he could, speaking against corruption and authority as he saw it. And still in exile, he eventually would pass away very peacefully in his sleep. So that's one example of somebody who went to the desert that God used. Another example is Amma, Mary of Egypt, born in Egypt.
Before you get married,
yes. Yes, please. Let's. Can you wait for the mic to get to you? Well, there are people who watch online. And if you've ever done that, I'm really frustrated when I hear people ask questions and I have no idea what they asked. So.
It's probably a stupid question, but I'm curious. the Catholics call a lot of people saint.
Mm-hmm.
Is he the Saint John, or is it the one in the Bible that they
talk about? There are many Saint Johns recognized in the Catholic Church. A saint is simply a holy person. That's what that word means. You have to meet specific requirements to become a saint. Sometimes it's very quick after your death, but it's always after your death. Mother Teresa, by the way, is already a saint recognized by the Catholic Church. He's one of many, Saint John. If they're talking about this one, they'll say Saint John Chrysostom. And Mary, it's Saint Mary, but not, they don't just say Saint Mary because that means Jesus' mother. They say Saint Mary of Egypt, just so you can distinguish. They didn't have last names, so they would come up with ways to distinguish them. That's not a stupid question. That's just a question. And probably other people were wondering that same thing. There's something interesting about this person. If you look in medieval art, like I searched Google trying to find an image that looked credible that I could show you. You can kind of look at from time to time as you're hearing her story. But there were a lot of images in Scripture that have her completely covered head to toe in hair, like fur almost. And you think, some people call her Hairy Mary. In fact, and people are like, why? What? Well, there was a legend that grew that at one point in the desert she is completely naked. In fact, and there's the legend that God covered her body with hair. So, but others say no, it was just her hair that grew long. But you'll see both, and yeah, you're looking at medieval art, and you're seeing all these saints, and all of a sudden there's Bigfoot, right? And you're like, where did that come from, and why is that there? You just have to understand the way they thought back then and the way they processed things. So Mary was born in Egypt. At age 12, she ran away from home. She ran away to the big city of Alexandria. And it was a big city. Historians estimate that the population was well over 500,000 at that time, which at that time, that was pretty serious. And she was a wild teenager. She lived the life. She was so off the charts, hungry for sex, that she frequently refused to even be paid for her services. She just was insatiable. She lived that crazy life even throughout her 20s. She, in her own words, she said, "I was driven by an insatiable and irrepressible passion. I was like a fire of public debauch." When she was around 30 years old, she heard about a group of Christian pilgrims in Alexandria who were going to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the holy city. And they were having a holy festival there. And she thought, it might be good to find some new pastures out there. Not for any religious experience, but for her passion, for her lust. She joined the pilgrims, even though she didn't have enough to pay for the passage. She found ways to help her finance her passage. They were flawed pilgrims. And so she was able to get there. And sure enough, in Jerusalem, she found new men to conquer. A whole new world for her. Christians, Jews, pagans, it didn't matter to her. Who they were, who they worshipped, didn't matter. But she did find herself intrigued by these passionate crowds who were there for this holy festival. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre had already been built. It was there. And at one point, the crowds were like ushering into that church for the festival. One day, when she wasn't busy, she decided, go check it, see what's happening in there, just to kind of check it out for myself. And she doesn't go into detail, but she recounts that when she went up to the door of the church building, she was prevented from entering by an unseen force. And it terrified her. She had never experienced anything like that in her life. Well, she knew exactly why she was being prevented from going into the house of God. It was because she had spent her life pursuing her passions. So she fell to her knees right there on the steps and begged God to forgive her for her sins. When she tried again, she was able to walk right in. So she went into the church, and inside, she heard a voice say to her, "If you will cross the Jordan River," remember they're in Jerusalem, okay? "If you will cross the Jordan River, you will find rest." Well, she had never found rest in her entire life. So she went to the desert on the other side of the Jordan. She took 3 loaves of bread with her and nothing else. They were used up pretty quickly. And when they were gone, she just decided she would live on whatever she could find in the wilderness. Now, remember, there are desert fathers out there. They've already got communities. So whenever she would meet one of these hermits, she would beg him to bless her. "Tell me something about Jesus." She didn't have a Bible or anything with her. "But I need something to think about while I'm out here." And one of these traveling monks, his name was Zosimus, something like that. He was in a monastery that was by the Jordan River. When he came upon her, he found her completely naked, barely recognizable as a human. She had withered so much. I mean, she wasn't eating much of anything. He gave her his cloak to cover her, and she begged him, "Please bless me. You're a monk. Please bless me." But he saw that she was a Christian who had gone to the desert of her own volition. And so he fell to his knees and asked her to bless him. And she tried to tell him, no, you don't know my past. I am in no position to offer a blessing for anybody. And he said, "But look at your devotion. Look at what you've sacrificed. All the worldly pleasures are gone for you that so attracted you at one point. So you are in a position. Please, you're holier than I am. Bless me." So this is what they said. Mary said, "I am ashamed, Abba, to speak to you of my disgraceful life. Forgive me for God's sake. But as you've already seen my naked body, I shall likewise lay bare before you my work," what she had done, the way she had lived, "so that you may know with what shame and obscenity my soul is filled." And so she revealed to him all her sinful life, everything she had done. It humiliated her to bring it up again, but she spoke it all. And when she finished, Zosimus asked her to pray for him. So she did. Now, he had to strain to hear her, but her prayer was so quiet, he couldn't hear any words, actual words that she was saying. So this story is remembered, and especially that end. People have really kind of hunkered down on that thing at the end where she was praying so quietly that he couldn't even hear her, and yet he was blessed by her. So John Chrysostom was remembered for his golden voice, and Mary of Egypt was remembered for being silent, for being quiet. God uses both kinds of people for his kingdom business. Well, Mary begged Zosimus to, in the spring, meet her again at the Jordan River. And so he did, and this time he brought communion with him. And he gave her communion, and she took communion. She asked if he could meet her again a year from then, so next spring, where he'd first found her. And Zosimus went there a year later and found her dead body. She had passed away. So he buried it there in the desert. But her story has lived on. Her story is not buried. And so even today, I mean, you may have never heard of her before, but there are parts of her life that I bet some of you can relate to and say, "You know, I've walked down some of those paths. And I know what it's like to be embarrassed to talk about it. But by confessing our sins to one another, we bless one another. Because they can say, oh, I thought I was the only one who had a past that should be buried. All right, so we've talked about the Sabbath. We've talked a little bit about deserts and about how God uses the desert. Jesus himself recognized how important it was for people, his people to retreat. He would call his followers and say, let's go with me. You know, let's cross the Sea of Galilee. Or let's go way up into Gentile region north from here. We would say up because it's on the map, it's north. They would actually say down because it's away from Jerusalem. But the point is, Jesus recognized it's important to get away sometimes. What do you think God thinks about people like the desert fathers and desert mothers who don't just go there for a retreat, they go there for good. They're going to live there. And you can also apply this, I think, to people who become monks and nuns in abbeys. What do you think about that? And if you'll raise your hand and give Terry a minute to get to you. You know, like children's church, this can be a very short discussion if nobody hasn't answered the question. Okay, yeah. Okay, hang on just a second. We'll get the microphone to you. You can speak right into the mic.
I said, can you repeat that for me?
He died for you? Yes, yes.
No, I said, can you repeat it?
Oh, okay, sorry. So what do you think God's opinion is, his perspective, on people who don't just use the desert for a retreat for a short time, they go out there to live for the rest of their lives? Okay, do you think God is okay with that? Do you think he, okay, all right. Sorry, Terry.
I think that, especially after the work of Constantine, popularizing Christianity, and I think that the church turned inward on itself. It started to form doctrines. We started to search more about the meaning of certain passages. These are all good things, but we turned the mission of the church around and turned it inward, whereas the mission has always been to go out and to save the lost.
Good.
We've come up with elaborate doctrines and theologies about finding the lost, mm-hmm. but we've lost a lot of the mission thinking, the missional thinking of actually going out and finding the lost. And part of the reason why they were drawn out in the first place was because they started to see this, I think. Mm-hmm. I think they started to see that Christianity became the world, and there was need to separate, to be set aside from the world still, even under the guise of Christianity, even under the name Christianity. Christianity became a nominal faith, a faith in name only, and they needed to set themselves apart from that. The problem that comes about whenever we completely take ourselves out of the world, completely remove ourselves from the mission, is that we have done just that. We've removed ourselves from the mission. We're no longer carrying out the work and the path of Jesus. We've set ourselves completely apart. There are some really good things that came of their separation, where people would go out and seek them. And good things came from that. But Jesus didn't stay separated. Mm-hmm. He kept coming back. He kept going back to the world. And so I think that God his opinion. I don't know that I can speak for his opinion on that.
That was an unfair question.
Sure,
yeah,
but I think that we can see both good and bad in that, and
yeah.
And it is good to separate ourselves. It is good to take the Sabbath to step out, but not stay there where we are no longer effective in the mission of God.
Good. That's a good way to say it. You made like, yeah, we'll get over to you. We made like, you made 3 points at least that I thought, man, that's a good point. That's a good point. So, number one, when Christianity became legal, you started seeing the development of weird theologies, just weird doctrines, weird beliefs. Well, it wasn't the first time you saw it, because we had Gnosticism going all the way back to the first century, things like that. But you saw a rise of it suddenly. And that is because when any system, a baseball team, doesn't matter what the system is, when any group of people feels threat from the outside, they band together. When that threat's removed, they turn against each other. And so we began to not only just have these doctrines, we began to define ourselves by which doctrine we believed. That's the kind of Christian I am. I believe this. And if you think about it, we still do that today. This is the kind of Christian I am. I don't believe in instruments, or I do believe instruments, or, you know, just those things become our defining principle. Whereas what he was saying is absolutely true. We've got to be defined as people on a mission, people who have been told to go. And so, yes, be on a retreat, like Jesus, go for a time, go for a limited time. If you plan to live the rest of your life there, you need to figure out how you're going to bless others with the gospel living out in the desert. John the Baptist did it. You know, he lived, and I think he planned the rest of his life to live out there. But if you're going to do it, you can't do it with just the thought, well, I'm going to pray for them and I hope that they get saved somehow. You've got to do it with at least yielding to God in some way to say, I'm going to have to go visit or something to be able to at least get the message to them. So we've got two people over here who'd like to make comments.
Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
David, I just have a question.
Yes.
Instead of, like, going to the desert, can you, like, go to your room and go and just, like...
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah. Like, just kind of study the word.
Yeah, when we talk about going into the desert or just being by ourselves, being alone... you know, you may think, well, there's that extension in Toll Park. I mean, does that count? Or do I have to go all the way out to White Sands? Or, you know, no, Jesus said, go into your closet and pray. Literally, he said to do that. So anywhere, the point is not your circumstance. The point is what's in here and your intent. So did you want to say something, Augustine? Or?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Janine? I'm sorry, Roxanne.
The desert reminds me of Moses. And even in God's discipline for them, they stayed there for 40 years. He never intended for them to stay there.
Right.
And
right.
40 years is a long time, but he never intended for them to stay there. It seems to me that the desert is a preparation for God's work. But if you always prep, if I'm always in school, I never apply
right.
what I'm being taught.
That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
Yeah, but that it's a place to go and prepare. Some preparation takes longer.
Yeah.
But still, it's getting you ready for something. Even Jesus, Lane alluded to this, that Jesus was in the desert for a time in preparation for the
right.
work that he was to do. So.
And that's such an important, Jim Bob's next, and then but while you're getting there, that's such an important aspect of being in the desert, to recognize this isn't going to last forever. When you're going through a tough time of your life and you're just in a desert experience, you can know this is a chapter in my story. It is not the entire story. Jim Bob?
I basically agree with everything that Lane said. However, I don't think we totally understand about monasteries and abbeys and so forth. When I was in school, I worked at a hospital, a Catholic hospital, mm-hmm. and Sister Mary took it upon herself to educate me in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And one of the things, one night I was working in the lab, and she came in, and she told me to come and look at, watch this film she had. And it was about an abbey in Louisiana, and those people, those nuns' mission was to take care of people with leprosy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at one time, there wasn't many places where lepers were treated. And anyway, that those ladies had dedicated themselves to caring for those people. So, you know, that's a mission.
Yeah.
And it's not really a retreat thing.
Yeah, when you talk about nuns and monks today in the Catholic Church, I, in my mind, have this idea of almost a building in Tibet on a cliff where they don't touch anything, don't see anybody. You will be hard-pressed to find any group of nuns or monks who don't have some sort of connection with people. I want to read from Hebrews. We were talking about, Rick was talking about Hebrews earlier, and because Roxanne made the reference to Moses, I want you to kind of start thinking in these terms. The people were in the desert because they were being trained to be lights to the nations. When they got into the promised land, God was going to use Israel to show the world how to come to him. Well, even the people in the desert rebelled against him. So God said, you must really like this desert, so you're going to live here the rest of your life. And it's not going to be you. In fact, you know, with Moses, you know, well, we'll get into that later because I realized I put that in my notes for a couple of classes down. But the point is, God wanted to give them rest, but they did not accept it. Okay? The writer of Hebrews talks about this. Listen to, I'm going to read just a few verses in chapter 4. He talks about Moses in chapter 3 offering the rest, but the people didn't enter it, and it was because of their disbelief. Verse 3 of Hebrews 4. Now we who have believed enter that rest. Just as God has said, so I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. And yet his works have been finished since the creation of the world. For some, skip a bit. Verse 8, for if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about any other day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Are you a person of God? Are you a child of God? There remains a Sabbath rest for you. Book, chapter, and verse right here, if you didn't like the passage Jesus referenced earlier, that I referenced of Jesus. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from their works, just as God did from his. Yes, from your day job, but also from trying to save yourself, from trying to put yourself on the throne. Verse 11, let us, therefore, make every effort to enter that rest so that no one will perish by following their, the Israelites, example of disobedience. Now, clearly, the writer of Hebrews is discussing, he's referring to a lifestyle, not just one day of the week. It's a whole mindset. And instead of discussing the question, I want you to take it with you. How can your life, your mindset, become that of a Sabbath rest? Not just a day. The day itself becomes a symbol. of something else in your life? How does your life, your mindset, become one that rests in God? All right, the next week and probably the week after, I'm not going to be here, but you'll be in the capable hands of some other elders, Jerry and Terry. So when I get back, we'll pick up with a little further down the pike on church history. Yeah, you bet. You betcha. My pleasure.